presentation of Dr. Bob Orse. No, no, I don't, I'm sorry. Wait a minute, do I have, is it set aside? What's first? Let's look.
That's correct.
Vim's is next.
Vim's is next. Dr. Orse. I've got it so rearranged on here, it's hard to keep up.
Which MPA will we turn out there to check these logs?
Trust that guy. I know.
I'm sorry.
Here it is. The industry doesn't claim they have these logs.
In the crab fishery.
Would it be possible to maybe turn the lights down?
Absolutely, Kathy.
Because of
the ship.
Because there's actually a bright spot.
You know, it's not the states.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Obviously, I've been up here a few minutes earlier, but this is my annual presentation to the Commission on SAV issues within the Chesapeake Bay. I appreciate the time, and I will try to be as brief as possible, although I know with two new members, I will try to be brief in letting you know what some of the issues are with regard to each one of these issues. These are the issues that I'll be talking about today in this presentation, and I'll highlight each one of them. First, we're going to talk about what's the bay-wide status of SAV in the Chesapeake Bay. And again, just as a heads up, SAV is being used as one of these sentinel species in terms of watching what happens with water quality. There's a lot of interest in, obviously, improving water quality. SAV species are very sensitive to clarity and other issues, and thus they are being used as one of the kind of canary in the cage type of parameter animals, plants. Okay, so as I mentioned, we keep our fingers on the pulse of every bit of grass in the Chesapeake Bay. We use aerial photography to monitor all the grass beds in the bay, and this is a history of that effort from 1984 through 2010. The Chesapeake Bay has a restoration goal of about 75,000 hectares or 185,000 acres. This is the history since 84 through 2010. We are presently at about 79,000, a little over almost 80,000 acres or little about 30,000 hectares. Here we are in 2010 from the past previous 4 years where we've had a decline in 2010. The 2011 numbers are not going to be pretty. I will have those for you next year, but we already mentioned some of the problems that happened in 2010. So this is where we are. It's not pretty in the Chesapeake Bay. We are at 44% of the 2010 goal. So we have a long way to go in terms of the restoration target for the Chesapeake Bay established by the Chesapeake Bay program. I've mentioned this before, but for the new members, the Commonwealth of Virginia's water quality standards now include SAV acreages as part of the water quality parameters, in particular water clarity, and basically every acre counts because within the Chesapeake Bay, as we talk about the cleanup, they are going to be looking at not just water clarity, but the number of acres of SAV in each of the Chesapeake Bay segments as a way of following water quality improvements. So we've gone a long way from just using water quality parameters. Now we're using habitat parameters for standards. So what's happening in the whole Chesapeake Bay? I've divided, and again, this is from last year, just updated, for all of the areas that are considered low salinity, medium salinity, and high salinity, which is us down here in the box, sort of. Here's what's happening in the low salinity areas versus the medium versus the high salinity areas. You see this dramatic increase over the last decade or so of plants in the freshwater area. This is the result of, one, an invasive species, hydrilla, that came into the bay, but also what we believe has been success in reducing nitrogen loading into the freshwater areas, and these plants are responding very well. The middle part of the bay, which is a big chunk of the bay, used to have many, many species. We now have one, which is widgeon grass. We've talked about widgeon grass being extremely dynamic, and you see that here in these ups and downs, where widgeon grass will be here 1 year and then gone the next and then reappear next year, which we do not still know what drives this population. And then here we are in our high salinity area, lower bay, and this is the 2010 number, which was a little above 2009, but the concern we have, and your eyes can basically pick this up, is that the long-term trend from the early 90s through this period is one of a downward trend, which really concerns us. And again, this is the area that, you know, we have most interest in with regard to eelgrass, because there's widgeon grass, but it is not a good replacement because of its dynamic nature. I mentioned that each particular segment for the Chesapeake Bay has a target or a goal. This is the Mobjack Bay, which is the mouth of the York River and the Mobjack and part of the Pocosin. Again, you can see some of the same issues we're having here, which is an area dominated by eelgrass and widgeonlass over the time period of 1984 through 2010. We saw a drop from 2010. Now, you see this low number in 2006. Again, I've talked about what happened in 2005. We had our first major heat spell that dramatically changed the eelgrass populations. This is that number, 2006, recording a huge decline in this particular region, which was mirrored in most of the bay. It has slowly been recovering, but we had a dieback in 2009. We had another one in 2010, which we'll see in 2011. So this trend for declining populations is one that really is is really of concern for us in terms of this important habitat in Chesapeake Bay. We talked about briefly regarding pulsed events. We all have heard in the news about Irene and Lee and its effects in the Chesapeake water, the Susquehanna watershed. This is a satellite picture of this sediment plume coming down from the Susquehanna River. This is the dam up here, the Conowingo Dam, and this big sediment plume is a result of an incredible amount of runoff that came into the bay from both Irene and Lee. The runoff was around 800,000 cubic feet per second. The highest level was about 1.13 million cubic feet per second from Tropical Agnes in 1972. So we hadn't seen this level of flow since 1972. So all this mud is what is concerning a lot of people in the freshwater, low salinity areas in the upper bay. How it impacts areas in the lower bay, probably not, because as you can see, this big sediment plume starts getting diluted with some of the lower bay water. So the plume has been making its way down to just about here, which is, this is actually Smith Island. This is the Bloodsworth Island and then Honga River. So that plume hasn't really made its way further down, but for the freshwater plants, this is something that we will be following very closely in the upper bay. But it was a very, very impressive event and one, again, unprecedented since 1972, other than it occurred in the late summer, early fall, which was perhaps a good time for this actually to happen. But again, we hadn't seen this in such a long time. One interesting good point, in the James River, again, we monitor all the grass beds in the James River. We have, until this year, not seen one plant in the main stem James River. This bed showed up this year. Here's the Chickahominy River. And just off of the Chickahominy, by the small creek, this bed of SAV showed up this year. This is rather significant because, again, we have not seen any plants surviving in the main stem James River. And this bed consists of both a native species and actually an invasive hydrilla. So whether this bed persists this coming year because of what we've been seeing in the James from both Irene and Lee, which was not as great as the upper bay, it all depends on a lot of parameters that affect these grass beds. But we've been waiting for many, many years to see if indeed maybe the upper James may eventually become vegetated, which would be rather unique.
But where would the origin of the seed come from if it's been vacant for so long?
Birds, waterfowl, the other is that you know, these freshwater plants can move very easily with boat trailers. So when people are fishing the Chickahominy, they uproot plants, and a lot of these plants may get exported, let's say, out of the Chickahominy,
right,
and may come up this way and then get embedded in these little creeks. You know, what we have been seeing in the James River is that all these little creeks like this throughout the James have now become vegetated. It's just that we haven't seen any plants show up in the main stem. This is the first bed since we started monitoring. Probably in the last 50 or 60 years, where there have been no SAV beds in the main stem James. This is truly a rather significant event. Now, again, what happens in subsequent years, we will be following, but this was an outstanding thing that happened. So we'll hopefully.
Mr. Fox has a question.
Do we want hydrilla or do we?
We have no choice. We're not going to have any choice whether we hydrilla. It is there. It is present throughout the bay.
Are you happy with hydrilla?
I am, yeah. Okay. I mean, here's an interesting story. When hydrilla first showed up in the Potomac River, people were adamant. They wanted to get rid of every single blade. The people who were most adamant about getting rid of it were some of the people who guide people in the James for fishing. It turned out that once hydrilla showed up, the fishing improved significantly because you had structure. You had structure for small fish to eat. And when we take our aerial pictures, it's really interesting to see where all the boats are lined up right along the edges of these beds. And now people are making very nice sums of money by guiding people. And, of course, now you have snakeheads in the Potomac, which is not a bad fish. So there's a lot of invasive stuff. We are not going to get rid of hydrilla ever. It's in the James, the Mattapani, the Pamunkey, the Rappahannock. It's in every single river system today.
But it performs a function.
It performs a function just like other SAV. Landowners may not like it because it gets sometimes pretty dense, and for people that have piers, they may have to remove a little bit of the vegetation to get their boats out. But all in all, it does exactly what most species do. It provides habitat. There's a lot of waterfowl associated with it, and it provides food. And the fishing along these edges of these freshwater areas is fairly spectacular. So, but again, this is a combination of native. And actually, one of the interesting things that has happened with the advent of hydrilla is that while we've never seen any plants in these systems prior to hydrilla, what happens once hydrilla comes in, it actually forms a really nice barrier and clears up the water. We now start seeing native plants come in. So in the shallow water areas with hydrilla, we now get to see some of these native plants showing up because they can now survive in these clearer conditions that hydrilla provides. So just let me conclude this first portion. The major issue for SAV, as I've probably mentioned before, is water quality, water quality, water quality. That is the number one issue for SAV and obviously a target for all of these agencies that want to make the bay a better bay than what it is today. This is changing because we now have climate change and increasing water temperatures. You've all heard that the bay is warming up. This is going to be a particular problem for the lower bay eelgrass, which doesn't like hot temperatures. And the other is, of course, these frequency and intensity of these major rain events that occur. And we've seen that not just in the spring when we saw a big rush of fresh water from all the snow that came into Pennsylvania, but also this event of Irene. So, again, this is something that we're going to have to watch and how this plays out in the future. Only nature will tell us what happens. Okay, let me move on to the Chincoteague Bay SAV Sanctuary. Again, for the two new people, back in the late 90s, we saw in these grass beds these big circular scars that were formed by these watermen who were pulling these nets looking for hard clams. But in their search, they were destroying the grass beds and forming these big circular scars. We worked with VMRC and the watermen to come up with a sanctuary that kept the dredging out of these very large grass beds. They were originally marked, but the markers came down and then subsequently marked with small poles. And this is the history of what's happened with the scarring in Chincoteague. This was the time period in which we saw a lot, and essentially we've been monitoring that, and we have seen since the time period they were marked, and actually the markers are no longer there. I think with effective enforcement and our own monitoring, the number of scars have essentially been down to zero, other than what we saw a few in 2007. We have not seen any in the last 3 years. So our sanctuary has worked, our enforcement has worked, and I think it because they also know that we watch very carefully, that we, I think, have made a pretty significant impact in obviously ending the scarring in Chincoteague Bay. Propeller scarring issues, again, this was brought before the commission several years ago, again, for the two new members. These propeller scars were formed by individuals who are pulling nets through the grass beds for fish, and these are propeller scars causing damage to the grass beds. We worked with the commission and the watermen to come up with a compromise by modifying the way they haul. We've monitored two big sites, which were the main areas for a lot of the haul, saying one off the Pocosin River, we call it the Pocosin site, and one we call the Browns Bay site, which is a big area from the mouth of the York River all the way into the Severn. What we do is, this is from the 1997 aerial photograph showing a lot of scars. We measure every single scar, how long they are, and what happens to that scar by looking at the photograph the next year. We can actually follow each one of those scars. These are the data for Browns Bay, the time period that we raised the issue that there was a lot of scarring. Again, the challenge was how do we minimize the impact to the watermen so that they can continue their work, but also minimize the damage to the grass beds. And again, working with the commission, coming up with a compromise of making sure that the hauling was done at an appropriate time, and when they get the fish out, they can move the boat so they wouldn't cause the scar. The effect is essentially, in the last 10 years, we've minimized the amount of scarring. So we've gone from over 100,000 linear meters of scarring to none. And one of the things that we did find, which actually allowed us to recommend that these areas not be closed, that these scars actually recover very quickly. The growth rates of these plants and the dynamics of these scars were such that the growth rates were phenomenal. And so that's what you see. All these scars formed this particular year recover very rapidly, so that within 3 years the recovery rate was so much that we couldn't see that scar. And again, because of working with the watermen in these areas, they recognize the need to change their methodology, which obviously has worked. Some scarring still does occur, and I kind of expanded the scale of Browns Bay so that you can see, instead of, you know, way up here 100,000, we're down to about 5,000 linear meters, which compared to previous years is not a lot. And again, we find that this level is acceptable because these scars do recover very rapidly, and I don't think it's a need to really raise this as an issue of any other changing techniques. It happens and they recover, so I think this has been an acceptable level of scarring. Coast and flats, same thing. Large numbers of scars in this time period when we brought the issue to the commission. Very few in the latter part of the years. And again, we highlighted this by just expanding the scale. And again, you can see in this time period that the scars are very low level. I actually talk on a regular basis with one of the hall seniors, Mr. Nathan Dryden. He's always obviously very interested in what we're finding. And when he finds out I'm ready to make a presentation, he calls me up and says, "What's happening?" So we had this very interesting conversation about, you know, what's happening in the Pocosin, because he is very concerned. He knows of the importance of grass in this area and recognizes that, you know, he wants to keep his livelihood alive. And so I think we have a pretty good relationship with the people that work on the Pocosin.
Well, Bob, you make a good point, because I can remember when this first came up. I mean, it was the room. We had a number of watermen here that were very concerned about the methodology that was being used to make these determinations. There were some skeptics. It was really uncharted ground. And by virtue of you going out with the Marine Law Enforcement Division, having dialogue with the watermen, to everyone's credit, especially the watermen who listened, saw what was going on, and modified the way they did business, I think that's has a lot to do with, you know, the benefits that we're seeing today.
I mean, I think they recognize the need to watch what they do, because this is their livelihood, and they pull these nets into these shallow water areas, and they know that a lot of the fish are in these shallow water areas primarily for the grass.
Yeah, I just think it was a good opportunity and a good example of everyone working together when they went down and met on the beach, talked it out, and came up with this solution. Right. It worked out well.
Now, let me make a point, because this is an interesting issue. Last year I brought before the commission a problem we saw with some of the scarring through an area that we were trying to enhance. This is the Coast Guard area in the York River. These were our restoration plots, and we saw, again, you know, these large propeller scars that were due to a hull seiner, a hull seining in this area. We met with a waterman, came up with what we thought was a respectable solution, which was putting a series of white PVC pipes on one side of all of our eelgrass areas, which we were restoring, because this was an area covered with eelgrass back in the late 60s. So we went out with Lionel. This is Mr. West, who is one of the hall seiners and one of the, I guess, more respected hall seiners. He's one of the elderly group that has been doing this for a while. So we went out, and I went out with Mr. O'Reilly, and we put out these stakes and said, okay, stay on this side and leave this grass alone, and you also just have a corridor where the damage to the grass would be minimal. And everyone agreed, great. So we thought, okay, let's see what happens. Well, okay, here's 2010. Now, this next shot is 2011, the same time period. What you can't see, of course, is where's all the grass? Well, remember, 2010 was the hot year. We lost a lot of the grass. Here are the stakes. Well, all the stakes are actually gone except for this one, which is kind of leaned over, and there are still scars. I talked with Mr. West the other day and expressed my concern, and I said, listen, somebody's not playing by the rules. That is, they have actually hauled over the stakes, pulled out the stakes with their nets, and actually I went out, and you can see this one stake is bent over. There's obviously, you know, evidence that this, the nets were pulled over. So what I told Lionel, I like to work it out with him first before I come back to you guys and say, let's try this another year. I'll meet with them and your law enforcement people sometime this winter when, you know, they're not working. You know, let them know what the deal is and say, okay, we'll try this one more year. And if it doesn't work, you know, then they face the issue of maybe closing out a very productive Hall St. area. And perhaps let's just see where it goes. I don't want to bring this as to an action item other than let us work it out with the guys first. If it works, that's great. And I think Lionel might be able to put a little more pressure on some of the people who aren't playing by the rules. And we'll go with that if that's okay with you for another year. And
perfectly
I'll work
fine with me.
The people that enforce these areas and come up with a way to deal with it. Aquaculture issues. This is a long history in that aquaculture likes to be in the shallow water areas. You saw a picture that was presented earlier from part of Baymark. The idea is that with aquaculture, you're not supposed to put nets on existing SAV. The gentleman, this is an area in the lower eastern shore, Bayside and Hungers Creek. This is a very nice, well-developed grass bed. And when we took our pictures this year, this is what we saw for the first time in this area. We said, whoa, this wasn't there last year. This shouldn't be there because this was a very well-developed grass bed for many, many, many years. So we brought the issue up to law enforcement. They said, okay, we're going to have to take action. They found the person who was doing this. They were going to take him to court. We said, okay, now, wait a minute. Let's talk to the people first. We met with the person who's working here, Mr. Lusk. He said that when he set these nets up in 2010, there was no grass. Now, remember, 2010 is when a lot of grass died out. Well, a lot of it came back. And he said when they put these nets out in 2010, there was no grass. Well, when I went out and checked this area, there was grass growing through the nets. There was grass everywhere. And he understood the nature of the issue. The fact is that he's invested a large amount of money in all of these aquaculture plots, which you can see these long rectangular areas, each 10 by 30 plot with a lot of clams. So, again, we said, listen, let's work out a compromise. And what we've kind of agreed on is that they will be allowed to keep the clams there until they harvest them. We felt that to try to remove them now, they would lose a lot of money. And we knew that if they were willing to work with us, we would allow them, well, not me, VMRC, but I think that we know a lot about the dynamics of eelgrass in this area, and that if when they harvest, they'll work with us to actually collect some seeds and reseed the area and then leave the area alone. So, again, I think by kind of working with these people in a compromise and knowing what we know now about the dynamics of grass and what we can or cannot do, this area is actually a relatively stable area, unlike some of the other areas. And, again, point out that this is a very productive seagrass habitat that we want to maintain. So I think this was, again, a kind of a good deal, a good compromise without having to come up with any new regulations and bringing people and going to court. Again, because we watch all these places, I hope that people that are doing this know that, you know, we kind of watch all these little grass beds. And
I think they do.
So, but, you know, they happen. And, again, I have found working with VMRC, the enforcement people, and your regulatory people, it's worked out pretty well. Last, the seagrass restoration of the coastal bays. This is a whole new avenue for us that has been just absolutely exciting compared to what we're seeing in the Chesapeake Bay. We've been working in the lower eastern shore seaside since about 1997 here and have found that our restoration efforts for an area that used to historically support large amounts of eelgrass and a very productive bay scallop fishery in the 20s and early 30s, we are having some of the biggest success story of anywhere in the world in getting grass back. We used a lot of volunteers in trying to restore grass. This is one of the areas that had not a blade of grass in 1997, is now covered with grass as thick as you can see, and just an actually beautifully, I mean, you can't imagine being where you are and saying, this is a rather impressive sight. Again, just to give you a little bit of heads up, if you're not familiar with the seaside, we're here. We have four big sites that we're working with that used to historically support big beds of eelgrass in South Bay, Cobb, Spider Crab, and Hog Island Bay. This is the set-aside that we're talking about today to try to get your approval. These areas are in public grounds, so we don't have to worry about set-asides, and we have a set-aside here in Hog Island Bay for our restoration work. This is a collage of pictures from 2001 through 2010. Again, this is from our monitoring work. This is an area, again, our set-aside, that in 2001, and again, you're looking through the belly of a plane at about 2 miles up. This is the coastal bay, coastal lagoon of South Bay. This is Wreck Island. You see a little bit of what looks like a B and a W. That's eelgrass that we planted that actually ended up in the shape of a B and a W. We planted a bunch of plants in 2001 and 2. These are those plots. By 2010, less than a decade later, this whole area has essentially become completely covered by eelgrass. Absolutely phenomenal, given that we are seeing the complete opposite in the Chesapeake Bay. This is a unique story that, again, I have had the privilege to participate in. I've never seen anything like this. It tells us how resilient the plants are when water quality is not challenging them to survive, how quickly they can recover once we put seeds in. It's just phenomenal. And so when you look at the graphics, for example, here, this is the number of hectares that we've seeded over time and the number of mapped acres or hectares. South Bay is the first bay that we worked in. We stopped actually seeding in 2005. And look what's happened just by the fact that we put a few seeds out, and it's taken off to where we have now a little over 1,000 hectares, which is, there's 2.47 acres in a hectare. That's a lot of grass. And it's thick. It's beautiful. It's an impressive sight to see. It tells us, again, a lot of what could happen if we can improve water quality in the Chesapeake Bay and bring the grass beds. And, again, we're seeing this in the other three bays here. It's a very impressive site. We've been monitoring the water quality through a variety of techniques that tell us a lot of why we're seeing this success, which I'll point out very briefly at the end of the talk. Okay, so here's the interesting sum story. Here we are, which I just mentioned, the coastal bays. The number of hectares of SAV in the coastal bays is going through the roof. In the Chesapeake Bay, declining. And Chincoteague Bay, which was increasing, is also declining. You know, this is a unique story, and again, tells us a lot of just how resilient the plants are when they are challenged by water quality, which is happening here in the Chesapeake Bay. And to put in perspective, this big polygon here is where eelgrass used to be in the 1960s. This is where we have eelgrass today, and this is what's been happening in this polygon right here. So the story is not pretty in Chesapeake Bay for the SAVs in the lower bay. This interesting picture in the coastal bay gives us a great system to contrast, you know, when, again, you're not really stressed by water quality. Let me touch very briefly on scallops because this is, you know, the neatest part of this project right now. Scallops require, bay scallops, these are bay scallops found in these coastal lagoons. These are the data from the harvest during the 20s and early 30s when eelgrass was really abundant. An impressive harvest, these are the dollars during that time period and the today's dollars. It truly was an impressive fishery, but once all the eelgrass died out and never recovered, the scallops went away. So we've targeted a scallop restoration effort in the coastal bays. We've been now working with Mark Lukenbach, who has been the co-PI in this project. Just a collage of pictures of what we're doing and where we're going with this. Again, because we now have eelgrass in these coastal bays, Mark has been raising bay scallops in his hatchery. We put these bay scallops, rather than let them freely roam, we put them in cages and have high-density numbers of scallops in these cages so they can spawn. And then our hope in hopefully another decade is actually to have a sustainable population of bay scallops. And if that's the case, then that's going to be an interesting kind of picture is what do we do then? Because this was a very productive fishery. And there are fisheries in North Carolina, and the restoration efforts they've had in Long Island have been very successful. So this would be a very interesting story in terms of how do we really maintain a sustainable population if we want to provide some harvest for these animals. So that story still has to be played out. We've seen this past spring, for the first time, large numbers of adult scallops in the grass beds where we do our harvesting of seeds. So we are seeing some of the successes of keeping these scallops in these trays and these cages so that they don't get eaten because, us, we like bay scallops, so do cow nose rays and other things. So
we went on a boat
right with you that right. day. And so by concentrating them and when they spawn, it obviously facilitates successful spawning and survival of these animals. And, again, I'm hoping that, you know, in my subsequent presentations in the next few years, we'll be able to give you some precise numbers of what we're seeing. We're actually going to do some surveys in the next month, trying to figure out how many adult scallops we see. We'll be doing that every fall and the spring, and those numbers will become available when I make the presentation next year. So, in summary, trying to wrap it up here quickly. Again, water quality, in particular, some of the nitrogen loading is going to remain kind of the major driver for our SAV restoration. But now that we've had a big problem with what we're seeing in terms of climate change, water tempers, and these pulse events, that's going to be another emerging, well, it is emerging, an emerging concern for our SAV populations. And again, this is not lost on all the managers of the bay that are trying to get grasses back, as well as all the other habitat that we have. You know, the anoxia problems, hypoxia problems, they're all linked and all play a role in, you know, what's happening with our other species. And again, eelgrasses, which is our main species in the lower bay, which we are concerned about, numbers in 2011 are not pretty. And again, it's a serious concern. The Chincoteague Bay Sanctuary and the propeller scarring, I think we've shown that with appropriate enforcement and monitoring that we can keep those levels down to either not happening or very low levels. I think monitoring is going to be necessary to continue, because I think when they know that we're up there in the sky and doing this work, I think it's part of the control measure to keep this effort in check. The aquaculture issues, again, we work very closely with VMRC. They're challenging, but again, are going to require a lot of compromises. There are more and more permits that are being submitted to VMRC in areas that are very shallow and that contain SAV. That will be, especially with oyster aquaculture coming to play, we are going to see more and more requests and more need to provide compromises with the aquaculture industry, because it's a new day for them. And but yet we have to maintain our populations of SAV that provide also important services. Coastal bays, great, fabulous. Our bay scallops next. That will be part of my future presentations. Let me just kind of close with these data. A lot of data, but let me tell you what we're looking at and why we're concerned about what's happening in the Chesapeake Bay. These are temperature data and light data in 2010 from May through October. These are from sensors that are out there taking data every single 15 seconds. Okay, so there's a monitor out there taking temperature and light measurements. And what you're looking at are four sites. Three sites are in the Chesapeake Bay: Ware River, Horn Harbor, and Goodwin Island. The Ware River is in the Mobject Bay. Horn Harbor is just above New Point on the main stem Chesapeake Bay, just below the Piankatank. And Goodwin Island is at the mouth of the York River. And our South Bay, which is where we're having our greatest success. And these are the temperature records for this time period. And your eye basically tells you, and you've been watching me show you data from the Chesapeake Bay. Here's South Bay, which is obviously much cooler. Here are the Chesapeake Bay records for our sites that have eelgrass, and much higher. The same thing with the light records. Light is much better in the coastal bays, because the lower you are to the zero mark, it means you're having much clearer water. And look at the records for the Chesapeake Bay. So, you know, what we've got is South Bay showing us when the water's clear and the temperatures are cooler, you know, eelgrass just loves it. We are being challenged in the bay again, as I said, by these higher temperatures and poor water clarity, which is the double whammy for eelgrass in the Chesapeake Bay. And again, you know, we're continuing to monitor. These data are important in the managing of the bay as well as this resource. But again, this is what's happening with our system down here in the lower Chesapeake. And the actions needed, just three of them. One, we hope we will get approval for continued monitoring for the propeller scar. We need your approval for the set-aside to continue and continuation of the scar monitoring throughout these sites. So that's it. I am here to answer any questions.
Kathy, lights, please, ma'am.
That's a lot that I give you, but I only have a half hour.
Well, it's always
a year, and it's a lot. A lot of information is on our website. We're always open if you have any questions to call us. A lot of our data is available to people on the website. Everything's open and transparent. And again, I think I've enjoyed very much working both with the watermen and VMRC staff in developing appropriate compromises that allow multiple uses in this particular system.
It's always good to have you here, Bob. I think not only does it provide an indicator as far as the actual tangible seagrass goings-on, but it also is kind of a gut check as far as the barometer of the health of the bay. I think you've demonstrated over the years that they go hand-in-hand as far as the water quality and the temperature and the light and things like that are a direct reflection on how well that, as you said, the canary in the coal mine works. So
I've become very sensitive to the waterman issues because I know whenever we raise an issue, the first thing they think of is a regulation, like you can't do this. And I think we've shown that kind of like working with them and, you know, trying to come up with appropriate compromises of, you know, making them aware of what's happening, you know, I think that's worked out really well.
To the benefit of all.
I mean, we're going to have continued problems, and I think our continued monitoring really plays a big role in that by letting them know, you know, we know what's going on. We can see it in our aerial photographs. And I think that plays an important role in this. Now, there's always going to be one or two. You know that. You get that here, you know, with people that don't want to follow the rules. And that happens. But I think, in general, we're finding that by working with people and letting them know, you know, we're willing to, you know, kind of talk things through has helped a lot in our relationship.
I agree.
So it's always going to be contentious. I mean, you know that. Anytime you try to come up with that regulation. So, you know, we'll be continuing this work for a while.
Good deal. Mr. Schick, you had a comment, question?
Now, as far as nitrogen versus water temperature, are there some areas where water temperature has increased in the nitrogen level or clarity has not been an issue? Or is it
– It's the low, actually, they go together.
Yeah,
the nitrogen issue is actually the nitrogen lows coming in at the watershed.
Right.
And that's why we think that with a lot of the efforts to reduce nitrogen through improvements in sewage treatment plants, which is just a start, is I think why we're starting to see some of the freshwater plants really recovering. That nitrogen issue in some of our trends is not as much of a problem in the lower bay. It's the temperature and the water clarity.
The water clarity,
right.
which
is due to turbidity.
Turbidity.
Yes. And that, you know, we're seeing a decline in actually clarity, and there are a lot of hypotheses about what's happening. The bay is not getting cleaner. It's getting dirtier. And when we go out and do a lot of diving, especially in the springtime, you know, when we dive in the waters that used to be crystal clear, you dive and now there's like a cloud. You know, there's this very fine particulate material that just stays resuspended over time, and people are really watching
this.
That's
stormwater runoff?
Well, there's a lot of theories. It's growth of very small plants that contribute to this, and that is being driven by nutrients. But there's an awful lot of very interesting physical, chemical, biological characteristics that occur within the sediment that may be driving some of this.
Right.
And the fact that we can't discount the fact that a lot of the benthic creatures that do a lot of bioturbation, change the dynamics of sediments, are gone from these deeper water areas because of the anoxic problems. And then these areas used to be, you know, places where rays and, you know, fish would feed. They're no longer available to them, so they're all moving into shallow water. So, you know, this is a highly integrated, complex system that we know that, and we're starting to see some of the nasty effects that are just not being pretty for seagrasses.
And there is a direct correlation, you think, between water temperature and the increased turbidity in these areas, or is it kind of
it's a double whammy that's just happening, yeah. I mean, again, whether it's correlated or just happening coincidentally, again, you know, people are out there looking at this particular issue because they are concerned, because they want to get the bay clear. You know, we believe that if the bay was clearer, the temperature issues would be negated. And that's the thing that we keep on telling. If you had clear water, these plants can deal with higher temperatures, but only to a certain degree. When it gets more turbid, they have to respire more, and therefore they need more light, but they're not getting it.
Right. Okay.
Further questions? Thank you. The next item that we do have is your set-aside.
Well, you have a couple things.
Sorry?
Approval of continuing jack the monitoring for the propeller scars, because that doesn't that come from you guys?
We can either do that now, or if you want to just do that with the other commercial and recreational.
We can do that then. I was going to go ahead and take the set-aside as an action item at the present time, as a request to continue the set-aside of 727.85 acres in South Bay for seagrass restoration that was established by the commission in August of 2006. And if it's the pleasure of the commission to continue that set-aside, the chair will entertain a motion.
So moved.
Motion made by Mr. Tankard, seconded by Mr. Schick. Further discussion on the matter? All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Mr. Robbins?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to be clear that includes all the staff recommendations, including those related to Regulation 4 VAC 20-70-120 as described here in the briefing book.
So I would presume that is correct.
Thank you.
Yes. and the monitoring we will take care of. Sonia at the direct commercial. Be fine. Anything else we can take? Got it covered?
Okay.